Mr. Bayes, reel one. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Lincoln.
Which year was this?
1922.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Lincoln?
No, I left Lincoln before I was 6 months old or something like that, and went down to Suffolk. And then I spent my schooling in Suffolk. My brothers and sisters were all schooled in there, and that's where we stayed until I got married and came here.
Whereabouts in Suffolk was it?
On the Norwich Road out of Ipswich.
And how old were you when you left school?
17.
Did you get a job?
No. Well, yes, that's not strictly true. At 17, the war broke out almost straight away. There was a question of whether I was going to university. Once the question of the war breaking out, that all died a natural death. My father expected us all to go straight in the forces. My oldest brother was already married. My sister was married. And my other brother was thinking about getting married. But as far as he and my father were concerned, apart from the son that was married, he expected us all to go in the forces. So there was no question of going in the forces. However, something had to be done until I was 18. And since he was an engineer, he used his contacts and got me appointed as a trainee metallurgist at a factory in Ipswich, who then promptly, really, worked a little bit of a flanker on me, in so much as I was coming up to 18, they registered me as a, what did they call it in those days, reserved occupation. So when I was 18 and hurtled round to join the RAF, as all my colleagues from school were doing, they said, oh no, you're in a reserved occupation. And this then remained unsolved for about 6 months until I hit my boss in a fit of rage over something. And then was the thing of whether I was... I was promptly dismissed, much to my joy, and I went round to the recruiting office and they said, oh no, you can't do that, they've reserved you, they can't just say you're... They de-reserved you just because you've hit your boss. And so they sent me back again. And it culminated in me sort of saying, look, I don't want to be in a reserved occupation, I want to be in the forces. And they said, well, if you really want to be, you can be. So I said, right, that's all I want.
Why was your father so keen on you to be in the forces?
Well... He was a distinguished soldier in the First World War, and we heard the war declared in church, and as was our want, my father hurtled round to the pub after church, and we all went home and was awaiting our Sunday roast, and... He came in a little bit late because he loved his food, and he said, I fixed it up with the colonel of the Suffolk Regiment. You boys, he'll enlist you this afternoon because they're going to France the next week. My mother did her top, as mothers would about sons, and said my oldest brother couldn't go, but he was ready to marry. He was ready, that was up to his wife. And my next older brother said, well, he didn't want to go in the army anyway, he wanted to go in the Air Force. And mother said to me, well, he's not going until he's 18. And that was the end of it.
What had been your father's military record?
He'd been an engineer of some distinction. In fact, he was Chevalier of the Legion of Honour, Croix de Guerre, twice mentioned dispatches, Monstar, he had the lot. And he and all his brothers had all been in the forces. His brothers had been in the Cambridgeshire Regiment. And they didn't expect sons not to go in the forces. You know, that was a de rigueur, you know. they were not, they were not pacifists by any means, as most of the Cambridgeshire people weren't. And so this is the reason we all went in. I think, as I think I told you on the phone, my father always thought we were all pretty poor stuff. And I was sure that I would be a more distinguished soldier than he was. But after I saw the first barrage going in, I decided perhaps he had got something. His parting remarks to we boys, if we sailed off to do our service, well, now this will make a man of you boys, and that was it.
I'm surprised that you hit your boss. You weren't a violent youth, were you?
It's a little bit... I don't think... how can I put this to you? I wasn't a violent youth, but I was distinguished in so much. If I'd known the war was going to break out, there was a great injustice done to me at school, in so much that I wasn't there when it happened. It was the last day of school, and I was swimming for my house, and we were all put in detention because somebody piled all the desk up in the classroom and hung a pair of ladies' knickers from the lights. And so we were all put in detention for the last afternoon at school, and I declined to accept it. And in those days, you did not decline to accept things from masters. And the master in charge told me to come out and to be hit. And I said, no, you come and get me. And in the end, I threatened to lay him out on the... If he touched me, to lay him out on the... So he sent me to the head, and I declined to go as well. So the head then sent his personal emissary to say, go in there and get thrashed. And I sent the emissary back and said, no, I wouldn't. So he said, then you're expelled. And so I was the only boy in the history of the school that I think was ever expelled on the last afternoon. It's an amusing aside, because my father was livid, because he said, you won't be able to go to university, you won't be able to do anything unless you go back and apologise. So I had to go back the following day, after the school was finished, but I saw the head and made my apologies, and which were accepted. But then, of course, the war broke out 1 month later. I would have never apologised if I'd known the war was going to break out. But not a violent man, Mr. Woodham. But, young and fit and free.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain's broadcast declaring war?
No, we were in church. And the verger came and spoke quietly to the vicar, and the vicar said, it is as we feared, war has now been declared, and let us pray. And that was it.
How did you feel about it, personally?
Oh, I thought, well, I'd seen the odd All Quiet on the Western Front, and I thought, well, I'm not going to enjoy this very much. I shall be in the army before I know where I was, but I thought, well, after all, well, yes, that's it. We'd have been expecting war to be declared, in any case. All the boys at school were all expecting war to be declared, and the previous year, all from the fourth form upwards had dug trenches in the school grounds for the Munich crisis. And I always remember that the geography master, who was housemaster for Grenville House, when Munich was declared and there was no peace in our time and all the rest of it, he said, we won't talk about geography today. We're going to talk about you boys have missed a great opportunity. We were probably more ready to fight a war. This was in September 1948. More ready to fight a war. It would have been a great chance for you boys to go and settle this German question once and for all. And I always remember that in later years, because he made a speech when the new boys were welcomed, about 20 years later, to my nephews. We all went to the same school and went to the same, of course, they had in the same houses, probably the same thing that happened to you at school. And so that was the attitude of the masters and the boys. He was going to settle this German problem once and for all. They'd been in the forces in the First World War, and they were quite happy to see all the boys go off to the Second World War.
Now, you joined the army then in 1940, I think.
No, 1940, of course, I was still 17. When I was 17, when war broke out, I was only just 17. And so as soon as France collapsed, I joined the local defence volunteers, which subsequently became the Home Guard. And we were quite well equipped in Suffolk. We were completely equipped by the end of July. And I stayed with them until I went in the following year when I went in the army.
Which LDV units was it?
Suffolk Regiment.
In Ipswich?
In Ipswich, yes. In retrospect, it was a bit of the first couple of months we just, living on the outskirts of Ipswich, as I did our platoon. We used to guard the waterworks at Aitkenham, which was a little hamlet outside Ipswich. And that's how it went on until the September time. And then we guarded perimeter pillboxes around, which was a pointless exercise. The German army would have gone through us like a dose of salt, but having been at that time, we thought we might be doing some good.
What kind of training personally did you get with the LDV?
Very good, really. Apart from the drill, they taught you very well to shoot, and they taught you about making Molotov cocktails and priming grenades and all this kind of thing. But really, that was quite a good training, I must say, because we were trained then mostly by ex-soldiers from the First World War who really knew something about what they were talking about.
Did you feel yourself that the Germans were going to invade at that time?
Oh, yes, very much so. We had our first call out when the mythical balloon went up, and there wasn't an invasion. But we were all picked up in army lorries and dumped all over bits and pieces of Suffolk to reinforce the British troops because the Germans had landed. We really expected the Germans to land.
Did you fear the thought of their landing?
No. No. Did I fear it? No, I was sort of quite looking forward to it. Go and fight. But it didn't happen. No, I don't think there's any fear of it whatsoever.
And was it a mixture of the very young and very old in the LDV?
Yes. I think there were about three or... You see, everybody tried, well, anybody worth a light tried to join what subsequently became the Home Guard. So you would have a whole lot of my age group who were waiting to go into the forces, because even when you volunteered, as I did in the beginning of 41, to go into the forces, there was a time lapse from the time you took the King's shilling to when you could go, because lack of training facilities. So I waited about 6 months, I think, from the time I volunteered, the time I was posted to a training regiment. So there's a whole lot of people like me, I suppose, 10% of the Home Guard were my age group, and the rest of them were made up of people in reserved occupations or the more elderly.
Were there any incidents that happened whilst you were serving with the Home Guard that you can recount?
Not really. Only we saw the odd plane shot down. We hoped we were going to be the ones that captured the bomber crews, but we never did, and so, no, not very much at all, no.
So, in 41, you joined the army itself. Can we take it up from there?
Well, I went to join the Air Force as all my contemporaries at school. Everybody wanted to be a fighter pilot. And one of, in fact, a boy that left 2 years before me, he's one of the first DFCs awarded during the war. And so everybody wanted to be like McNamara, going to get the DFC. And so, my eyes weren't good enough. And subsequently, they turned my brother down because he was colorblind, because we didn't know he was colorblind. And the older brother, he was accepted.
And so what did you do once your eyesight was found unsuitable?
They said, well, if we go into ground staff, and I said I wasn't interested in the ground staff. And then they did a selling job on me and said, well, we're establishing a new corps, the Royal Armoured Corps. In fact, I was one of the first intake into it, I think. There's not many of those badges about, the Royal Armoured Corps badges. And there you will need the technical expertise and all the rest of it, and you're the type of people, I say it was a selling job, you're the type of people who want, will you put your name down for the Royal Armoured Corps? So I thought, yes, I'll go in the Royal Armoured Corps. So I took the King's shilling and then waited.
Did you have to wait long?
Nearly, somewhere between 4 and 6 months. And then I was posted to the cavalry barracks at Tidworth.
What happened to you there?
Pardon?
What happened to you there?
They gave me a very good training. They turned me from a callow youth into a soldier. I didn't learn anything about war. And I didn't learn anything about fighting. But they gave me a very good basic training. And they also taught me to drive and taught me to be a gunner. But everything, all the training equipment was bits and pieces of old hat, obsolete equipment. They hadn't got the stuff to train you on modern stuff. So they could only train you on things like Matilda tanks was about the latest thing that they had in option, which were already obsolete by that time. But the training was, they instilled in me, I felt the greatest thing that they did for me, I was in the 61st Training Regiment, which was the 4th Hussars Training Regiment. And I was absolutely enthralled with the history and traditions of the Hussar regiments. And had it been in a different kind of war, I'm sure I'd have been a great cavalryman.
Did you have any problems with any parts of the course or the training?
No. The only one little problem, I was passed for officer cadet, and it was unfortunate. I had another chap from Suffolk, a chap named Chard, as it turned out, who was in the same training regiment. And because we overstayed our leave, they said, well, you'll have to wait for the next selection board again because you've overstayed your leave purely by 8 hours. The fact was, London was being bombed and we couldn't get across London. And there were no trains going out of, I think it was Waterloo. And they said it wouldn't be any till 8 o'clock in the morning. And so I said to this chap, Bobby Charn, come on, we'll go and stay with my sister, because my sister had been a nurse. She, by this time, was married, and she'd been bombed out twice and lived at Morden. And so he went and spent the night there. There was nowhere else to spend the night. And London was still being bombed, so we went and spent the night in Morden and then caught the train. We got back at about 9:30 in the morning, by which time we'd overstayed our leave officially. And although we had reported to the the transit officer on the station, and he'd say, well, you can't go anywhere, there's no trains out. Later, that was not accepted. In fact, we should have got back somehow. And so they said, well, you'll have to wait for the next officer's training board. Although you've passed it, we'll go back to square one and have to wait again. So I said, well, no, I didn't feel like waiting again. Once again, I felt this sense of injustice. I think it would be more fun to go into the parachute regiment anyway. And they said, you know, nobody's allowed to transfer from the armoured corps to the parachute regiment. Well, one of the people in the training regiment was a chap named Bobby Gaisford, whose godfather was in the War Office, Brigadier Gaisford. And he said, write to my godfather and he might be able to get you posted. And I did. And after that, my feet didn't touch before I was posted abroad. So I was then posted abroad.
Where to?
Africa. The desert. And so off I went with the 46th Tank Regiment.
This is in 42, presumably.
Pardon?
This is in 1942.
The beginning of 42, March, I think.
What was the voyage like there?
Pardon?
What was the voyage like to Africa?
Horrendous. The Alamein, the first Battle of Alamein was still about to start. In other words, the 8th Army was in full retreat. And we were on the Mouton. And there was a whole brigade of us on the Mouton, which was quite a small liner, really. And there were 4,000 of us on it. And they hadn't had time to revictual the ship. And we literally were sleeping in hammocks, like sardines in a can. Underneath there were the mess tables, and people were sleeping on the mess tables, and people were sleeping under the mess tables. There wasn't enough water. Everything had to be done in seawater, because there'd be no time to revictual the ship at all. Everything was get somebody out to Egypt as quickly as can. We stopped at Cape Town. I must say, the reason the conditions were so awful, of course, the ship was be battened down for light and what have you, so there was no air going through it whatsoever. It was like a black hole of Calcutta. But when we got to Cape Town, the South Africans made a marvellous fuss of us, and the ship got some food on board and what have you, and then we sailed off quite happily up to Suez. And then, from there, we went to the base camp at Tel Kebir, took over the tanks. I wasn't made welcome by the 46th Tank Regiment. They were a territorial regiment of Liverpool Welsh, and they rather thought that nothing occurred, anything out of that wasn't good that came from anywhere else except Liverpool. So I wasn't made very welcome there. I couldn't do any of the jobs that really they needed. In other words, before they'd sailed, they'd turfed out their lame and their sick and their blind, and just taken in a 20 of us to make up numbers.
So it must have been a rather unhappy period for you then.
I never had any sorrows from the casualties accepted by the 46th Tank Regiment. And I thought they were rather, how can I put it, the only thing they resented it because I think from the rank and file, that I was better educated, you can imagine it, from Liverpool. They would have loved to have taken what fun they could out of this chap that could speak the King's English and not in broad Liverpudlian scouts. I never was happy. And the chap that I was very friendly with, there were three of us who became very friendly. And the chap, I think, was the bravest chap of the lot. I never knew until a week ago that he couldn't stand the Liverpool Welsh either, and he joined them as a territory before the war.
But you joined them in the Canal Zone originally, did you?
Yes. I joined them in this country and went straight abroad with them.
And did you go into action with them in North Africa?
No. Well, they had all their tank crews and everything made up, and I'd never driven the... I've never been in a tank crew. I've never done any training as a tank crew apart from firing the gun, and I don't think I'd ever driven a Valentine. They drove up, and I was LOB. I will keep on referring to LOB. You've had it often, I'm sure, in these interviews, left out of battle. And there's reinforcements, and you trailed up in one of the ammunition wagon or the fuel wagon, waiting for your call. And we got bogged down. The attack was going in the following morning. They went straight up and virtually straight into action with appalling staff work, very amateurish. And of course they got cut to ribbons on their first action. Starting off in the morning, they'd had 44%, I think they had 44% dead by midday.
Where was this?
It was Wyssett Ridge. And we had got... it was really a colossal mess-up. We were a very amateurish army, I'm afraid, the whole thing. We didn't deserve, really, to win at all.
What specific weaknesses did you...
Pardon?
What specific weaknesses did you see?
In retrospect, this, of course, I was only a callow youth then, but nobody really knew what they were doing. And nobody ever really liaised. I mean, there was no provision for anybody else to tell you what was... And this was still even so at Anzio, and on Anzio I began to get my act put together then, and I knew what I was about. Anyway, they got cut to ribbons, and there were only, I think, out of the 100 of the two battalions that attacked in that morning, of 114 tanks, I think there were only about 8 returned. It was just a massacre, and. So then there was a question. This is where I first realised I wasn't going to win the VC, which I expected to win, because we were bogged down in soft sand with this lorry with us perched on top of all the ammunition, what have you. So, and soft sand in the desert was an absolute swine. You would do about 5 yards and then stick again and 5 yards. So we were stuck out overnight. And... the barrage was about 3 miles further on,